This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations.
Merdeka! Merdeka! Merdeka!
The country of Indonesia.
Do they like me in Indonesia?
100% confident Indonesia will prevail.
Hello and welcome to Talking Indonesia. I am Tito Ambio from RMIT University. One of the joys of being a co-host of a podcast like this is in finding amazing research to share with you. And I think you'll like this week's episode as it touches on so many things that we love about Indonesia and also about being a researcher and being a part of knowledge production about Indonesia. Bronwyn Beach Jones is a PhD candidate who just finished her PhD at the University of Melbourne and a recipient of the Hanson Scholarship in History. And her PhD called Textual Worlds, Rethinking Self, Community and Activism in Colonial Era Sumatran Women's Newspaper Archives, looks at how women and girls from the island of Sumatra talked about their experiences and think about themselves, their communities, and their dreams in Malay language periodicals published between 1912 and 1929. In this interview, she'll share with you what she has found in her research about writing, about being young women writers in the colonial era, but also about what we can learn from these young women about building strong communities. And also, please stay until the end because there's a little bonus that we'd like to share with you. Welcome to the studio, Bronwyn. Really, really nice to be here with you talking about your thesis. How are you feeling after, you know, you finished writing your PhD, right?
I have. So firstly, thank you for having me. I feel excited to be here. It's lovely to talk about research that I've done since 2019, and I feel fresher now, a few months after submitting my PhD, and also excited. I think I had a sense that the PhD would be the end of a journey, but actually it's just the beginning of thinking more deeply about these topics and also of my own career.
Yeah, what do you mean that it's just the beginning?
I think I had this sense that I needed to write something that was answered all of the questions, but really it answers some of those questions and asks other questions about these women, these schools and newspapers that I research in early 20th century Sumatra. And it's opened up different ways of thinking about history and those pasts and how we relate to pasts as historians. And I really hope to do also more work in thinking what could this mean for other people outside of academia, within communities, and what it might mean for the Indonesian women's movement today as well.
Now, can you tell us, summarize what your PhD was? Just let's start with that.
An excellent question, something that we get asked a lot as PhD students as well, so I hope that my elevator pitch is good now.
Yes.
So my PhD is about individual women and girl writers and the communities that they formed in three women's newspapers that were published in Sumatra between 1912 and 1929. So really during this early period of national agitation, and also thinking about how writing itself was a process through which these girls and women came to understand who they were, their communities, who they wanted to be, what opportunities they demanded, and how that also formed a different way of viewing the world and what the world should be.
And what were you looking specifically?
So that was my broad kind of frame, was just what did these women and girls, what meaning did they give to these publications? And from that, I came to research the schools that they attended, and particularly schools that they demanded, particularly craft schools, weaving and lace making schools that were kind of acceptable feminine spaces for learning, but also for teaching. So in these newspapers, the schools that they taught in, and then how these spaces and agendas get broadened to Congress by the late 1920s, thinking of course about the Youth Congress that we all know about of 1928, the Indonesian Women's Congress of December 1928 that probably less people knew about, but it has greater prominence now. And then in a regional setting, I was writing about Sumatra. There's also a Sumatran Women's Congress held in 1929, so very much within that same historical moment. So through that lens and with these actors, also my research is interested in regional and local spheres of activism that are happening not only in the lead up to nationalist activism, but also at the same time as nationalist activism, which I hope will contribute to different ways of thinking about how the local, the national, and the international interact with each other.
So you're looking at this group of women writing at a certain period around the 20s, 30s, and you're basically looking at, okay, the connections between them and the ideas that they brought. What were the challenges of doing this, of researching Indonesian women's history in the colonial era, especially when you're looking at the print culture? What were the challenges that you found?
Great question. So the newspapers that I concentrate on in the 1910s and the 1920s, and I think a lot of us know and have read personal letters, particularly of Kartini, from the turn of the century period. In this 1910s and 1920s, there are still low levels of female literacy in Indonesia, but growing levels, with the expansion of opportunities for girls to attend school after the ethical policy of 1901, then in particular areas there are higher levels of education. So that's to set the scene. But then the challenges are also opportunities, I think. So these newspapers are written in Malay, so in a vernacular Malay, but also combine local languages. Many of these women and girls are Minang, so they combine Minang language, but also Jang for women and girls from Bengkulu, different forms of Malay, Achenese, other languages from Sumatra. And they also don't obey what we would think of as standard grammar. So these are women and girls who are thinking about their world, the languages they use, whether that be Dutch or English, local languages and Malay, and combining it together to articulate how they see the world. So it's challenging to read as a 21st century historian today, and I'm a non-Indonesian historian, so there are practical challenges in coming to understand what is meant. But at the same time, these are great opportunities to think that just because standard grammar would say that it needs to be said or articulated in this way, that's not the only way of thinking about language and the world.
Yeah, definitely.
So they're practical challenges. And then taking a step back from the language itself, these newspapers are relatively hard to find. We are very lucky that we have nearly complete archives of the three newspapers. So three newspapers, Sunting Melayu, which is edited by two women, Rana Kudus and Zubeda Ratnajuwita. Rana Kudus recently became a national hero. And that newspaper was very long running for a newspaper at the time. It's a weekly, it was published between 1912 and 1921. And there's nearly full archives of those weekly editions that are held in the National Library in Jakarta, and also on microfilm at a few universities around the world, including at Monash University. So I'm very lucky working in Melbourne that it is available. And the two other newspapers there's Pachia archives of Perempuan Bergerak that was published in Medan in 1920, and then Asrak, which is published in Padang, the same as Sunting Melayu, from 1925 to 1929. And I access those from now digitized copies held in West Sumatra. So kind of assembling those archives together and thinking that these, and finding those connections, you were saying, that these were women and girls who wrote and thought about the same issues, but then also had personal connections and friendships forged in those newspapers and in schools. And that was challenges, but I hope also opportunities to think differently about Indonesian women's history and to take it out of an individual lens and frame and rather think about communities and networks and how girls and women connected to each other, sought to form relationships, not only with other women and girls, but also with men, also with ideas that range from their local communities right up to international influences.
When you listen to people just using mixing languages. Mm. You know, we hear on YouTube, for example, young Indonesians, women, men, mixing languages, you know, local language, English. I think like what you've maybe this is what you found as well, right? Sometimes you need to mix different words and, you know, to capture the complexities of your ideas. And yeah, it's more fun to be a descriptivist rather than a prescriptivist.
I think so. And I think in contemporary Indonesia today, there is sometimes a hierarchy of accents or how people speak a language, particularly the cultural capital of a Jakarta accent or Indonesian that is inflected with Javanese. But there, here we have rich archives of different language possibilities.
Yeah.
And whether that be mixing and whether that be Malay and Dutch as well. These are all the different languages that went to form the worlds that these women and girls lived in.
Now, let's talk about positionality, which is relevant here, right? You reading the, you know, you're trying to understand the minds of these women, and you know, you, as you mentioned before, you're not Indonesian, you're not Minang. How do you negotiate that challenge of being a non-Indonesian researcher, especially if we think about the legacies of the histories of extractive knowledge production in Indonesia?
Yeah, absolutely, and this is something I've done a lot of thinking about and kind of grappled with in my PhD. And as I mentioned before, I have immense privilege. It was much easier to locate, digitize Sunting Melayu from Monash University than it was for Indonesian researchers for a very long time. It's very exciting that these sources are becoming more available, more digitized. I've always sat uneasy with that for many years. I could access this more than the families of the descendants of these women could, and also local researchers researching in these parts of Indonesia and particularly Sumatra. And it's from grappling with that and the dynamic, kind of endlessly fascinating nature of these archives that I've come to really think about reading. And I think historians have done a lot of theorizing of reading, but also a lot of theorizing of listening. Historians and scholars of other disciplines as well, and listening in respectful ways and learning with and learning from sources rather than extracting pieces of information. So I'd really try to center the women and girls I write about by thinking of that my interpretation is growing out of their work, and they are theorizing themselves and making knowledge themselves. It is not the Western researcher is the one who will produce all of this theoretical knowledge from the kind of raw data set of women from the global south. I really think about this as an exchange, and I have come to think of, for instance, the methodology of reading from the inside out in dialogue with the women and girls who I read. There's a particular short quote from young woman who I read a lot of across 1912 to 1921, Amna Karim from Bengkulu, and she wrote a lot about what she felt like when she was writing. And at one moment she wrote that she paused and then, quote, and the writer continued. And it was from that I started to think about how we are all in the midst of something, but as scholars we also arrive in the midst of lives and we make sense of it. And that's how I started to think about that. It is that inside-out experience of making sense of a life, a community, a world from the words themselves.
Which is a complex thing to do, right?
I agree. I think it's complex, and it's so, it's never-ending as well, dialogues. But that is also requires thinking in a different way, thinking that perhaps my account is the most comprehensive analysis so far of these works. The methodology that I've set up hopefully is flexible enough to always be willing and open for there to be more. And then also as a scholar myself to think that this is just the beginning of stories about these women who have not been the subject of scholarly analysis in the past, and that this requires time as well. This is a slow analysis that is, I've been very lucky to do because of the privilege of having a scholarship to do a PhD. And it requires that type of institutional support to encourage more slow work and slow reading. And then we can expand what we know about the past and who gets to be a historical actor and a historical agent if that support is granted.
It's a beautiful thing that you're doing. And you mentioned Amna Karim just before. Can you tell us about her?
Sure. She's one of the main characters in my thesis and someone who I have thought about every day since about 2017 when I started doing research on something Melayu of my honours thesis that then became too big and became my PhD eventually. Yeah. Karim was born around the turn of the century in Bengkulu. She was from a very privileged family. Her father, Abdul Karim, was a graduate from a prestigious teaching college in Bukit Tinggi. Her older sister, Mayanar, she was one of the first five girls to attend Dutch language primary school in Bengkulu in 1905. And Amna's sister, Mayanar, wrote about this experience of isolation as well as the doors that opened for her and how she began to think differently about her life and about the essential equality between girls and boys and men and women from attending primary school. So it was very transformative for her, but it was also very challenging, and she was teased quite mercilessly by boys in her class.
What kind of teasing did she get?
I mean, she doesn't go into the details of what it was, but she says that she emboldened her heart from the taunts of boys and also men and women. Think about the very isolating experience for very young children, 5 and 7 years old, of attending school for the first time. And Mayanar wrote about this quite a few years later, but it was obviously a very pivotal moment in her life. So Amna attends school perhaps a few years later than that. She finishes her Dutch language primary school around 1913, which is when she comes to write in Sunting Melayu very regularly about the importance of schooling. She thinks that through schooling that girls will be knowledgeable and less likely to be manipulated in life, to be having one's own opinion and decide for oneself what one wants.
Can we hear some of the things that she wrote? Yeah, I know that you brought some quotes from her.
Okay, so this is after she's finished primary school, she writes, "As the days turn to night, the writer feels it in her heart, like a thorn in her flesh, like a bone in her throat. It is this feeling that becomes intoxicating in her thoughts and cannot be held back, a feeling which hastens until this very moment." So she's writing about the importance of writing and the importance of schooling in this. And she, around this time, starts to call for this school and writes very beautifully, very poignantly about her dream to be able to teach. So she writes that larger the Himalayas, but even larger does my hope feel. And she writes over a period of multiple years until 1916 about how she really yearns for this school. And it's from about 1915 that she comes into correspondence and dialogue through Sunting Melayu with other girls from the region of Bengkulu who've been more successful in calling for the establishment of a government girls' school. So one, Zainab, wrote about establishing a school in Churup and advocating and working together with the assistant resident who then sought a government subsidy for this girls' school. So we can see that there's also the trading of experiences and tactics for how to establish this girls' school that Amna so yearns for. And it's not until the resident changes in this colonial residency of Bengkulu and Elsie Vesterinck is appointed that we see this kind of changing of the tide in Amna's dream for this school. And it is eventually established in March 1916. She goes on to become a teacher, reading and writing at this school. When the newspaper suggests that she worked there until the newspaper finished in 1921. So through the newspaper archive, we can see this establishment of a school, and it also gives such life to one quite throwaway line in the residents' report that he did community consultation to establish a school. And Elsie Bestenig wrote that a Benkulu girl teaches here.
Right.
So from the archive of Sunting Melayu, we can shine such light and humanize who was this Benkulu girl, and also see that it wasn't that she was involved right at the last moment of establishing this school. This is her dream of establishing somewhere she could teach and to open, you know, the opportunity to sit on a school bench for more girls and also to learn practical skills, weaving, lace making, how to mend clothes, how to make clothes. And so these were feminine skills, socially acceptable, usually took place after, in the afternoon, kind of after more formal schooling. But also she is teaching reading and writing here. And there is a sense that through this space, it is a way of what it could be to be a young woman in colonial Indonesia. But Amna's story doesn't finish there. So we have this school being established, 1916. She's also so active in this community of Sunting Melayu. And then from 1918, she meets the patron of Sunting Melayu, Datu Sudan Maharaja, very prominent Minangkabau, adat leader, local politician, entrepreneur, press entrepreneur, who's the patron. Amna meets him at a night market in Bengkulu. And shortly after that, she becomes editor, co-editor of Sunting Melayu, which is a role that she uses to draw attention to prominent, important social issues facing her community. So she writes about the spread of influenza and the mitigation measures such as closing schools. It's from some of these letters about mitigation that I learnt that her older sister, Mayana, who had that such isolating experience, she went on to teach at a weaving school.
Yeah, right.
So we see how even within this short amount of time, these schools did provide more female employment as well and answered those calls of ambition. Amna also writes a really remarkable letter bringing attention to domestic and intimate violence committed within her own family and calling for more women to become doctors and for healthcare to be able to be provided in discreet ways that would not be a barrier for women to seek care for something that's so highly taboo. And this is really remarkable, writing in 1918, 1919 about violence within her own family. So we can see how important she thought writing was, not only to articulate her sense of herself, but also as a platform for change.
Now, yeah, she seems like an amazing woman, of course. But also the weaving part of the story, it's more than just weaving, isn't it? Because, you know, often we think of these things as, yeah, like what you said, you know, feminine arts. We don't take it as seriously. We call it craft instead of arts, you know. But weaving was a central thing for the in the lives of these women as well, right? So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Weaving and then this kind of constellation of craft, weaving, lace making, embroidery, are at the heart of forms of knowledge that are gendered. And so at the start of Sunting Melayu, particularly the co-editor Zubida Ratnaduwita writes about feminine knowledges and this as women's strength and women's intelligence and a way of rebuking men who are a bit dubious about whether women can write and think that maybe women are helped by men and maybe not writing themselves in the newspaper. And there is these fantastic rebuke of Smita Ranjujuita writing about different forms of knowledge that women have, of wordcraft that women perform at points in the life cycle, but also that's connected to craft and connected to skills that take training, that are complex, that require putting multiple elements together. And we see through this that women, that craft becomes a way of thinking about processes of production, including writing. And there's individuality in that, and there's also discipline in that. Mm. And I think we can see this kind of tension between both the individual expression and agency of this, but also craft and weaving schools
mm.
as spaces in which what it meant to be a woman, what it meant to be a Minang woman, for many of these women, it was disciplined and structured and often funded, particularly by male adat leaders who had a particular vision of self-sufficiency, of cultural nationalism, that in some ways was articulated by women and girls themselves, but also women and girls who wrote in these newspapers often wrote about how it was learning from a woman teacher how to be polite, how to be intelligent, how to be strong, that they got out of weaving classes and this kind of all-female space of these classes.
Yeah, because when we think of philosophy, for example, right, we mm-hmm. think of, what's that famous statue, the thinker, right? Mm. Like a man thinking seriously about things. We think of the images of Socrates walking around with his students talking about life. But I guess this weaving classes were also, like what you said, this is where they also think about the complexities of life through feminine knowledge.
Mm. Yes, and I think the element of sociality is also important here.
Mm.
That these classes and spaces that are recounted, it's always about sitting at the bench with another student. Where are the teachers? We're all in a group. Sometimes it's recounted in a very structured way, like there is a timetable, there is a clock, different skills for different hours. But sometimes it's in a much more kind of organic way, with schools like those ones I was talking about in Bengkulu often had quite limited resources. Girls were bringing looms from home. We also get the sense of this was collective dreams. These were individual dreams, but then they were also embodied, enacted with others, which I think has extended into how I have also treated the space of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Different knowledges being put together and then also learning being an individual and also a collective pursuit and activity.
With your thesis, you look at, you look at Amna Karim, but you also look at the connections between her and other women and the links between them. Can you tell us a little bit about why you did that?
Yeah, I think, again, that it emerged from the archives themselves, that these are always networked. So the Sunti Melayu, for instance, was 4 pages, 3 of which were letters. So the dialogue is so present. So writers were writing to each other, learning from each other, sometimes engaging in parangpana, pen wars. So was not always a kind of peaceful, we need to break apart the sense that women don't fight with each other. There's always kind of tensions and rivalries happening at the same time. But these are all in relationship with each other and seeking to learn from each other, learn from others' experiences, or seek connection in more isolating experiences like moving or going to school. So from that, I started to think about the type of life stories I could tell. I think at the beginning of my PhD, I thought of life stories in a very discreet way. Like I would go away, read the archives, come up with a life, write it down. But really, as I started reading and following one writer through all of their letters in a year and across years, I started to see that they were always in connection with others. So from there, I started to see the very networked nature of these spaces and then thought that is a contribution as well to Indonesian women's history, is to think more and shine more light on who else is in this picture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to finish the story of Amna as well, her life is written through Sunti Melayu, and then Sunti Melayu finishes quite suddenly in 1921. And then in another newspaper, Asrak, that I was reading, which started in 1925, there is an obituary to Amna, because only 2 years after Sunti Melayu finished, so in 1923, Amna was murdered by her husband.
Mm.
And I learn about this through an obituary to Amna 2 years after her death. And so someone wanted her legacy to be known in a women's textual space of Asrak years after Sunting Melayu had finished. And it shows the prominence that she had. Also how important it was to share the legacy of prominent women in these communities, in these textual communities. And that also is an example of how it's not one woman's story, it's multiple women's stories, and we learn about it through these multiple sources. So this quite anonymous, only signed with the initials RA obituary is part of Amna's life story.
What kind of legacy has she left in her hometown, or well, in Indonesia in general as well?
I think this is the open question, thinking about women like Amna, who were so instrumental in establishing schools that lived on, but also through these textual communities in inspiring, learning from other women and girls.
Yeah.
So she's part of this. And then in my thesis, I kind of trace her legacies on into this era of Congress and conferences. So as I mentioned before, in 1929, there's a Sumatran Women's Congress. And after this, there is a play performed. And this play's tableau actually is a condemnation of male violence.
Mm.
And this is a publicly performed and very forthright. And we can see this, that there were women in writing about such taboo issues and then talking about it more public and performing plays linked to these themes. So you can see the legacies of activism that's transformed from their personal experience and writing about it within one's own family to this textual community into agenda.
Thank you very much, Bronwyn. I think, you know, I was joking when I said, you know, we're not going to be here for 3 hours, but I feel like we can. So, as you said, finishing the PhD is just the beginning for you. So, thank you very much. Is there a quote from that you want to read to end the interview?
Oh, very good. I think it is. Let me have it. Okay. I think it would be fitting to finish with Amna.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, this is from the same letter that I read from before, from 1915, and she articulates kind of why writing is a form of truth-telling from her body. So she writes, "I truly mean what I stated above. I did not slip away on a daydream. In fact, one could say that it was with God's help, whose power is awe as well as nature, that I convey intentions that have long been inscribed in and carried by my heart. And at that time, I could not refuse my will, so the writer was forced to put it down in full."
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bronwyn.
Thank you very much.
So that's where we ended the interview. But we both thought, Bronwyn and I, we thought we can't end this podcast episode without reading more of the letters and without having another voice being read. The voice of Mayanar, the sister of Amna Karim, who plays a central role in her story. And I'm really glad I asked Bronwyn to read it. It's a beautiful letter and read beautifully as well. Enjoy.
"I was nearly 6 years old when I began to be taken by my father to school. It was the year 1905, and at that time, girls in my homeland did not yet go to school, apart from me and my sister and the teacher's children, 3 or 4 of us. I had to bear a great amount during that time. I was teased and laughed at by girls in my homeland, young, old, unmarried. And I did not care about any of it. I emboldened my heart, and even more so with the taunts of boys at my school. Also, it was the thinking of women in my homeland that there was no purpose in girls learning at school. They said it was necessary for boys alone. So I thought, what is the difference between girls and boys? Supposing that us girls possess intelligence, then certainly wherever we go, we will not be deceived because we are well educated. Am I correct?" ¶¶